The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel is Reese Davis.
The top four remains the same in the latest college football playoff rankings. Coaching contract extensions come, and what about Clemson? Are they being overlooked? This is the College Game Day podcast for Wednesday, November 23rd, the day before Thanksgiving. We wish all of you a happy Thanksgiving. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here. So, Pete, the top four in the college football playoff rankings stay exactly the same. What they did over the weekend was the closest margin of victory in the history of the playoff for weeks in which the top four teams have been perfect. They won by a grand total of 26 points. Wasn't too bothered by it. LSU ranked one spot ahead of USC, so a two-loss team threatening and on the doorstep of being able to get in the playoff if LSU could win the SEC. Did you have any big reaction to the rankings that you saw?
Yeah, my big reaction, Reese, was my pride in you trying to use a crowbar to get a decent answer out of Boo Corrigan. And he said to you, the Latin translation was, "I'm just here so I don't get fined." In other words, the lingering tension of this weekend is obviously if the loser of the Buckeyes and the Wolverines, 2-3 in the Big House, both 11-0, undefeated first time meeting since 06, if the loser gets in the game. And that is the biggest question hanging over the sport. And you certainly recognize the moment and challenged Boo Corrigan to a follow-up, and he gave you the Heisman, 2 weeks before the ceremony. So, well, and I understand both sides. Journalistically, you did absolutely the right thing in asking the question America wanted to know. And if I'm Boo, I'm not putting my horses on any. I'm not putting my money on any horses right now. So it bites me later. So it was an amusing back and forth. So yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah.
And the thing is I always because I've done this every year of the playoff, I know what they're up against, and the stock answer they always give you that I tried to navigate around was that we don't look forward. So there's no way you could just ask him about the loser. So you have to find a way to ask him how they evaluated them up to this point and what they could withstand or something of that nature. Because the two things that will trip you up, because it's just normal conversation to talk about conferences. And you have to word it in such a way where you ask about schedules, because they'll fall back on that. We don't evaluate conferences. We evaluate each individual team, and they will never project. And you understand that, because it can, as you rightly said, it could paint them in a corner. But I think it's really obvious, at least to me, barring a bunch of teams losing and melting down and Michigan being the only remaining choice, should it lose Saturday. Michigan is not in a good place to be able to lose the game and still have a strong case. Ohio State's case would be stronger in the event that they lost a close game to Michigan on Saturday.
I agree with that completely, Reese. And I think that Ohio State's case with a loss gets even stronger if Notre Dame upsets USC. That would be a dual power, because it would knock USC out of the conversation completely, and it would add to the credibility of Ohio State's non-conference schedule. If they were to lose to Michigan, then obviously they wouldn't go to the Big Ten title game, and they'd lack that. But I do. It's hard to just say it's going to be like white hat, black hat, right? Like Ohio State loses, they're in. Michigan, right. Because there's, and this is what we get so caught up in the playoff and absolutes, and then chaos unfolds every week. And it's sort of this pattern of like, there's no chance USC's in the playoff. USC's a favorite to go in the playoff. But it makes the sport great, right? Irrational reactions and such. But yeah, I really do think that this is going to be the most watched game of the year this weekend. Game day is going to be there. We're fired up for, what'll be the best 3 hours for us this season. There's no better content than undefeated, century-old rivals with the stakes being high, a historic tinge with this, with, you know, the playoff evolving and changing and the Big Ten, you know, divisions evolving and changing. So it's just, there is I've covered a bunch of these games over the years. They're always special. I mean, every time you can watch Ohio State and Michigan, it's special. But I do feel like there's an aura around this game that makes it like a once-a-decade special or maybe even generationally special. So a lot of eyes will be on this game, and I really think that the tenor of how it unfolds will go. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about this game today, Reese. I have a breakdown on ESPN.com, and I talked to 15 coaches and scouts about it. None of them think anyone's going to blow anybody out. Let's be honest, mm-hmm. right? Like, this mm-hmm. is special teams, field goal, run game, you know, one possession. The weather's going to be a factor. It's going to be all that. So, yeah, the playoff stakes are just one of many subplots in what's going to be one of the juiciest games that I really think I've ever covered. Yeah,
it's one of the things that I want to capture early in the show, maybe even in the scene set, what you alluded to. And the thing that's running through my mind is that we may never come this way again with Ohio State and Michigan. You say, oh, you know, it's hyperbole, you're overreacting to this, but here's what I mean. This is the fourth time that these two teams have met with perfect records. There's one more undefeated versus undefeated, but Michigan had a couple of ties in 73, I think, off the top of my head. That may be wrong, and I'm sure the Buckeyes will tell me if it is. But the point being is that it's rare enough in these circumstances that you have the high-stakes games. But you mentioned the Big Ten changing divisions. The playoff is going to expand potentially in 2 years. And whereas Ohio State has had to live with that loss in Ann Arbor for just shy of 365 days, Michigan's getting ripped off by a week, just the way the calendar's falling or right in that neighborhood. It could be that in future years that bragging rights for the regular season game last 6 days until you play 7 days later in the Big Ten championship game. And then maybe that would last nearly a month until you potentially meet again in the playoff. So to capture what this means, and this is really the epitome of what you and I've talked about a few times on this podcast, that the winner take all stakes, or the winner at least taking most and maybe all, some of that is about to be lost. And I don't want to sit there and bemoan the fact that it's being lost. On Saturday morning, I want to celebrate that for what it is. Two yeah. great old rivals with a high stakes, potentially season-making versus season-devastating game for on one day that everybody will have to live with for a year. And it's fantastic. It's nerve-wracking if you're on either side of it, both as a player, coach, or a fan. But for those of us who are just watching, it's spectacular.
So the 30 for 30 will be called the last great regular season game.
Well, maybe we'll have another one somewhere in the next year or two. And
who's, you know, the Midwestern Wright Thompson who can do the voiceover? Yeah. Day was not born on third base.
But, you know, there will still be great regular season games. I'm not trying to say that. Course. I'm just saying that by definition, the stakes are going to be different. And if you don't have divisions, then how many years is it going to be they're going to turn around and play again? Now, we say that, and maybe it won't happen because, you know, that's how these things go.
Here's an interesting little philosophical twinge to that. These teams have always met, you know, late November, this weekend. Uh-oh. I think, like, this game, if this game was played on September 18th, it would like my body clock would go off. Yeah, like it would just be the weirdest thing ever. And I saw Gene Smith said publicly this week that he hopes that the date stays, you know, in the final weekend of the year. That just feels right. I don't know. Do you think that changes? Like, how do you?
I don't think so. I hope not. We need to hold on to some tradition. Now, I know in the state of Oklahoma, Bedlam's important, but it's not Michigan and Ohio State in the grand scheme of things. And they've sort of messed with Bedlam a little bit by moving it a week early because they were worried about them rematching. I think you just play it on the traditional day. And if you rematch, you rematch, you know, because I mean, there'll be plenty of years that you don't. Some years it's going to kind of stink. you know, some years when that does happen, or I don't know if stink's the right word, because it could just be two great games. It could diminish what the regular season means, particularly if you have a situation where both have already clinched a spot in the Big Ten championship game, and both, for all practical purpose, would have a spot in the playoff. You know, that could really give it a late season NFL feel to it that, you know, we really could do without.
I'll give you the quick Bedlam comp here. Ohio State, Michigan. Michigan has won 59 games. Ohio State has won 51, and there's been six ties. So you would say that's generally fairly even for a century of people playing football. Mm-hmm. Old Bedlam is 91-19.
Yeah.
Sooners over Cowboys. So it's just again, I am not going to discount in the state of Oklahoma how important Bedlam is, just like I would never discount the Civil War or whatever they're calling it now in Oregon, or the Egg Bowl. I mean, in those communities, that this weekend is actually what makes college football great. We talk a lot on this podcast about what makes college football great, and we love about it, but there is nothing better than just relentless rivalries after rivalry after rivalry, just unfolding. And you've got the split marriages, and you've got the families divided. And I mean, that to me, you know, Patriots Jets just doesn't touch that as a rivalry. If that makes sense, it's just one of the best parts of the sport as it unfolds this weekend. But the unique part of Ohio State, Michigan is it's that type of searing rivalry, but the stakes often transcend to national. And you know, there's been few meetings, if any, that have higher stakes nationally than this one.
Oh, and nobody has met more often as top five opponents. And we are recording this podcast, so it's going to be too late. But the Ohio State fans can, and the Michigan fans, cannot bother to tweet. The 73 game I mentioned finished in a tie. It was 75 that both came unbeaten, but Michigan was like 8-0-2, I guess. Or anyway, they had two ties, but they were unbeaten. So there you go. So there's the cleanup on aisle four for that one. You mentioned talking to coaches, and this was a tremendous piece, both your written word on ESPN.com and the way you helped us fashion and formatted the piece that we did before the Tennessee-Georgia game on game day, which took quotes from coaches who knew both teams, outlined strengths and weaknesses, where they thought particular advantages might lie. And then our guys react to it, whether they agree, disagree, they can illustrate it with videotape, whatever it is. And we're going to do that again Saturday on game day. You did the legwork on this by talking to all of these coaches who were involved. What was something that you discovered that maybe surprised you or you didn't expect to hear in preparation for this game?
I'll give one on each side to be balanced and fair to our rivalry we're discussing here. So we obviously know Michigan has a good offensive line. All right, that's not breaking news. They won the Joe Moore Award last year. They may be better this year with Big Olu coming in at center from Oluwatimi. I know you're a big enunciator, so I just want to make sure I land the plane on that for you, Reese. He's the starting center who was an excellent player at Virginia, and he came and has melded in and really is their best NFL prospect on that line and has really elevated it some. What was surprising to me was that the reverence in which coach after coach spoke about that offensive line in terms of how it played together. It brought back the Brett Bielema borderline erotic quote from a post game back in Fayetteville many moons ago. Then these coaches started talking about the sum being greater than the parts and how they ran inside zone and the symmetry and how well precise and well coached they were and just how the whole unit rose together. Like, I was blown away because I obviously knew. And if you watch Michigan, they clearly have a good offensive line. Blake Corum's special. Mm-hmm. One thing they said actually is that he's small enough where he kind of hides behind some of those dudes. So he can be hard for linebackers to find. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. But that was really the coach after coach. That was really the hallmark of this Michigan team, was the synchronization of that offensive line. I think that's the right word. So, and one of the cool things about the segment when we did it for Tennessee, Georgia, other than me still getting trolled on Twitter because somebody said that Tennessee was going to score 50, was
not like you said it, you know,
was how you guys brought it alive, right? Like you guys were able to take on the on the Zotron, you were able to take the clips and David Pollack was able to show what the coaches were saying. I thought that was like a really powerful way to get that across. So I'm excited for that for Saturday. And I have a feeling that somebody's going to take Marvin Harrison Jr. As the guy they want to illuminate. So on the Ohio State side, again, not breaking news that Marvin Harrison Jr. is good, elite, et cetera. What was interesting, we've hinted at it on the podcast a little bit here, was a scout gave me an interesting argument of why he could end up as the number one pick in the draft next year. Now, will he be number one? Probably not. Caleb Williams, Drake May. I mean, those guys are, you know, fashioning themselves to be a Luck RG3 type, you know, quarterback draft year. But that said, the part of the argument that I thought was very interesting was because the passing game has really just ushered itself to the forefront in football. Remember when the Bengals took Ja'Marr Chase, everyone went, oh my God, the Bengals took Ja'Marr Chase. Like, this is the Bengals being the Bengals, right? It's like their worst pick since they took Pollack in the first round. That was a joke. but really, they took Ja'Marr Chase and went to the Super Bowl. And Jameson Williams is injured and he went 12. So the, you know, just like we had a recalibration of running backs falling in value, this scout predicted we have a recalibration of receivers increasing in value. So if you have a quarterback, you don't hesitate to take Marvin Harrison in the top three. Whereas 10 years ago, if you took a receiver in the top three, everyone would say you're nuts. But not only is he elite, until last week, he may have had a drop against Maryland on like a attempt at a circus catch. But yeah. I was told he did not have a drop all year. He's done unbelievable circus catches, and he's like the most respected guy in the building in terms of work ethic, everything. So he's, again, there's no perfect prospects, but as a receiver, he's shaping up to be a guy who could be a top three type pick or maybe even the first pick in the draft, which was pretty cool to hear those scouts really consistently go through, especially the parts where how respected he was by the coaches and the strength coaches.
You know, on the subject of the drops, I know the play you're talking about because, you know, Joe and Greg, I'm pretty sure Joe and Greg called that game. Joe Tessitore and Greg McElroy do a fabulous job. And that they were talking about, you know, I that may go down as a drop. And I was like, well, that's not even fair because, I mean, when you think drop, you think of one you probably should have caught.
You think of the TCU tailback
in the 2-point conversion. That's a drop.
And I'll even go a little farther, you know, some tough catches. Something that was near humanly impossible that he almost somehow caught, but got his hands on it and didn't finish it. I hope they didn't give him one on that because that was he's just been spectacular and amazing. I ran across this. You know, the last time Michigan won in Columbus was 2000. Do you know what the head coach of the Buckeyes was doing the last time Michigan won in Columbus?
So Ryan Day and I are about the same age.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit older. So my guess would be he was the starting quarterback for the UNH Wildcats.
That's exactly right. Under the direction of his offensive coordinator, Chip Kelly.
Yes, yes. And we should not forget Sean McDonald, who just retired, who started a coaching farm up there in Durham, New Hampshire. I actually took a trip to Durham once to do a story on Chip when he was the OC at Oregon. So it was way back in the day. Sean McDonald, one of the best humans in all of football that I've met. And it was startling being in Autzen Stadium one week and then being in Durham the next week where they have a Got Milk is like their big thing, not a swoosh. Like it's a little bit different there. Can I tell my favorite Ohio State Michigan rivalry story?
Please do.
So one of my favorite stories I did while working at Sports Illustrated, remember that they have that Where Are They Now issue?
Mm-hmm.
So I went and spent like 2 days with Drew Henson, who was a baseball scout at the time. I think he might be an NFL scout now. Anyway, Drew Henson, wonderful guy, relentlessly interesting. And I'd never scouted a baseball game. So we went to like Clearwater, Tampa, somewhere down there, met Drew, we had lunch, great interview, was reflective on his football, baseball careers. The great Drew Henson stat is that he has one hit and one touchdown pass for his entire career in major. Like that is the statistical probability of that happening is just, you know, one in infinite, right? But Drew Henson's best season of baseball came in Columbus, and he had beaten Ohio State as the Michigan quarterback. And he told me effing time he went to the plate for the entire season, it might have been 2 years, he got booed by fans in Columbus, even though he was playing for the
Columbus.
Yes. Yes. Because he played for Michigan.
Yeah.
Every single time he's like, it got old. It got really old. I'd walk up in the middle of July and be like, really? My third at bat? You're booing me? That you is know, petty, Reese. That is the petty we admire.
We like the petty in the rivalries. And he was the starting quarterback in that game. Yes. I mentioned the last time they won there.
So how about it was that?
They won in the back-to-back, the last time they won back-to-back against the Buckeyes. It was Brady, 99, and Henson in 2000.
How about that? Yeah. So the Brady was, that was my senior year of college. And Syracuse went to the Big House. It would have been 98. Syracuse went to the Big House and just dump trucked Michigan with Donovan McNabb. I mean, they thumped him. And Brady got booed and they brought in Drew Henson in the place. It was like that moment of hope. So it's kind of funny. Small world now. Yeah. A little different, but I think Tom Brady has a little more than one touchdown pass. So
Just a few more, although
he has more game winning Super Bowl touchdown passes than Drew Henson had NFL touchdowns.
Yeah, we probably ought not compare investments right now with him and others, but I digress into something that is not the subject matter of this podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
So if Blake Corum is not 100% or can't go, I mean, I really feel like, I mean, I know Donovan Edwards has also been hurt. That changes everything for Michigan because Ohio State's found another back, maybe not as dynamic as, you know, as Mayan Williams and Travion Henderson if they can't go. But, you know, I think that if Michigan doesn't have their guy, then this idea that they're going to use that offensive line, they're going to run the inside zone, you know, the most difficult play a lot of coaches will tell you to run in the running game and run it consistently. But you need Corum and his experience and running the right track and finding the holes and slipping through tackles and all the things that he does so exceptionally well. I think it's going to be really almost impossible for Michigan to control the game without him, and certainly without the two of them. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I think every coach I talked to about a path. So 10 of the coaches and scouts picked Ohio State, 5 picked Michigan. I thought that was more that picked Michigan than I would have thought. Again, it's a 7.5-point favorites on the road, right? They haven't won there in 2 decades. So I thought that was it. But every path was control the game, grind the clock. And people were really, really high on Michigan's special teams. Now, it's funny. I did most of these interviews before last week. So Jake Moody, again, reminds us, you know, that he's one of the elite kickers we have in college football. And then people call the Ohio State special teams passive. Of course, Lathan Ransom blocks a punt that changes the game. And he blocks a punt for the second year in a row. Now, it was the first time Ohio State against Indiana. It was the first time they blocked a punt since 2019. So they do not inherently put pressure on you on special teams where the coaches were adamant that Michigan does. But I think, too, Reese, you mentioned the injuries. Mike Morris didn't play last week, who's Michigan's top edge rusher. Schoonmaker, the tight end, who's really like a sixth appendage, like a sixth offensive lineman. Scouts really liked him. I did not think, you know, some of these scouts even said, hey, he could fly into the first round. Like they really thought because he has downfield playing ability and also is a bruising blocker, he's kind of a rare dog. And I know he was good, but I didn't think of him as, you know, first round, second, you know, certainly first 2-day prospect. So there'll be, again, this is more for me than anyone else, but with Donovan Edwards, Blake Corum, Trevor Keegan, one of their guards, didn't play against Illinois. Like, there's just a lot. Like, there's mm-hmm. a lot of lingering variables here that makes it hard to talk about this game in absolutes. Just like Mayan Williams, obviously, we don't know his status. There was some optimism there, but we won't know till this week. And then obviously Trevion Henderson played against Maryland, but he did not look like Trevion Henderson. He had 4 negative carries. He just didn't look like himself. So, yeah, but I don't think Michigan is going to win this game if JJ McCarthy has to, drop back 42 times and try to pick Ohio State apart. I just don't think that's how it is. I think they need to methodically squeeze the life out of the Buckeye offense, starting with the run game.
I think that that McCarthy's going to be a really good college quarterback, maybe more than that at some point, but I don't think that point is here yet. Yeah. Passing the ball, but he's a really good athlete, and maybe a little more with the stakes being so high, maybe a little more or even more JJ McCarthy run on Saturday will be something that they use. And as it pertains to Ohio State's running back situation, I mean, Dallin Hayden was terrific. It was against Maryland, a little different than doing it against Michigan, but certainly he had to gain some confidence if he is the guy who is called upon for the bulk of the carries on Saturday. I mean, he's, he had 3 touchdowns, 143 yards, first guy with 100 yards rushing in the second half, since Henderson did it last year. And I know they'd love to have their 2 big guys, but the freshman has shown that he can carry his weight in the backfield for Ohio State.
Yeah, and I think the most promising thing about Hayden's performance was not only gives him another option, or maybe even an option, right? Mm-hmm. But also, he ran slippery. I thought that was the best way to describe him. He had no negative carries and really was just able to. Ohio State's going to have a hard time winning this game if they can't run the ball. Now, they have a talented offensive line. It was interesting. All the coaches and scouts, nobody thought Michigan's O-line was more talented than Ohio State's. You've got, obviously, DeJuan Jones, who's a Sequoia, right, at 6'8", 363. You got Paris Johnson, who Mel Kiper has as a top 10 pick. You have 5 linemen who are all probably going to get drafted, but there was just not that same synchronization. Now, people were very clear to note that they improved with Justin Fry being hired from Greg Stuwara. Like, there was a noticeable uptick, but it was not to the same level. And some of that, I think, is like Ohio State's an outside zone team. They don't pride themselves on like the sort of tough physical interior runs because they're just more of a spread team. And quite frankly, they have dudes who can scoot on the outside. So it probably behooves them to run that way. So obviously your run game is going to be structured around your talent. But this cannot be one of these like Ryan Day tries to score 60 games. I think there has to be some semblance of balance, which their whole offseason overhaul, bringing in Jim Knowles, putting an onus on competitive stamina, which I think was their like kind of new age version of toughness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of this was geared towards this game. And I really think it is a referendum on all those things. Cause if you go out and lose by 2 touchdowns again, and they run a 300 burger down your throat on the ground and average 7+ yards a carry, all that is probably going to be remembered as empty rhetoric. So that I think that's why the stakes are pretty fascinating here in a lot of ways, because Ohio State literally re-engineered their entire program to stop the run in this game, right? Mm-hmm. And to be better in this game. So in that story, there's some fun ESPN stats and info stats of like mm-hmm. how Knowles has gotten better pressuring the quarterback, or like getting pressure. They're number 2 in the country, stopping runs under 5 yards. They went from the 60s to like the 30s. Like, so there's a ton of cool tangible evidence of how much better. And quite frankly, I think they went from 59th to 9th in total defense, right? So that pesky old analytic yards, they allow less of them now. But I think a lot of that progress will not be remembered if they don't have one more point on the scoreboard at the Shoe on Saturday.
And they responded. And Michigan, now this is kind of what Harbaugh's always wanted to do, or has always done when he was, at Stanford and then early in the days in Michigan. But they seem to come to the realization that they're not going to necessarily go out there and start beating Ohio State for all of these recruits. So they were going to find a different way. And it's very reminiscent of what Jim did at Stanford to compete with USC and ultimately pass them. And when every year you would come back and you would think, okay, well, at least until SC got bad, but you would think, okay, they're going to get him this year. And then they really didn't. And, you know, so they're going to try to bully them. They're going to believe that they are the stronger team mentally, that they are the superheroes. And adding a little dash of spice to this is I don't think that Jim and Ryan Day will be vacationing together on the New Hampshire shore or maybe somewhere in the Upper Peninsula in the off season necessarily. That's not really going to be a situation that occurs, is it?
It is not. So there's actually some game day chatter on emails and texts today about, trying to prepare and set the stakes for the show, right? And nothing sets the tone for a rivalry better than, I wouldn't even say it was a shot, because that makes it sound like it was a jab. I mean, mm-hmm. Harbaugh, when he won last year, took a haymaker right at Ryan Day. It is something that actually cut right to the core. By saying essentially he was, born on third base without hitting a triple, meaning Urban Meyer handed him, a Lamborghini and he just kept driving it.
Yeah.
Now, I would think, especially when you look at this team, Ryan Day's recruited every one of these guys. There might be an odd 50-year alignment or something like that. But, when you talk about C.J. Stroud, Travion Henderson, J.T. Tulumoloau, did I get that right?
Yep, Tulumoloau.
When you look at Marvin Harrison Jr., when you look at this is Ryan Day's program now, mm-hmm. and it is humming along just fine. But Ryan Day comes from pretty modest background in New Hampshire. When he was nine, his dad died of suicide, and he's a blue-collar guy and a blue-collar kid. He prides himself on that. So knowing him a bit, we haven't had Ryan Day isn't the kind of guy to have a deep philosophical discussion about something like that, but just knowing his DNA and who he is and where he's from, that stung. And that is the kind of thing that is going to drive the program. Ryan Day is one of the most competitive people I've been around. He is like viscerally competitive. And so I will be curious to see how that manifests itself, but it's certainly set a delicious tone. Usually Harbaugh is like pretty defiantly boring too. You know what I mean? He didn't drop a whole lot of those, right? This isn't Lane Kiffin. So it was interesting that he decided to do that after, quite frankly, getting manhandled for three straight years. And then it was the COVID year.
But when he does, they're interesting because, he had the comment when Urban was there that wherever Urban goes, controversy follows. He has raised question about how much on-field instruction was going on during the offseason at Ohio State. So when he does say something, then there was the famous, what's your deal with Pete Carroll. So when he does, it usually sticks. There are a couple things there that stuck out to me about what you said. It was a haymaker that Harbaugh threw at him about the third base thing, but it is true that he was handed the keys to the Lamborghini. But what people don't realize is that it takes a huge talent not to run the Lamborghini off the cliff. We've seen that happen plenty of times. And, Ryan Day, it is his program, and he is an elite coach, and he's capable of, of winning national championships and building programs. It's one of the things, to be fair, that I said about Lincoln Riley when he took the USC job was that he was handed a really good program. He drove the Lamborghini beautifully. Now let's see if he can go to the garage and build one. Well, he ordered a whole bunch of parts and put together a really good one. Ryan Day
came Amazon Prime too because of the
program. Yes, he did get him immediately. And, Ryan has been able to do it through recruiting. Lincoln did it through the transfer portal. He'll eventually do it with a combination of both, I'm sure. And I think the game that Riley's Trojans have with Notre Dame on Saturday night, there are similarities in terms of stylistically how the two teams want to play with Notre Dame and USC that you see in Michigan and Ohio State. Michigan needs to be physical, run the ball, control the tempo. Notre Dame hopes to do the same thing against USC and maybe throw the ball to the tight end a lot, not just because they have Michael Mayer, but because in USC's only loss this year, they gave up 16 catches to the tight end, Dalton Kincaid of Utah. So I think there's some similarities stylistically in whether you're going to see a Michigan win or if you're going to see a Notre Dame upset in USC in terms of how the game needs to be played.
Yeah, and I think in the same realm, now there's not a lot of diamondism in Notre Dame's pass game. And other than Mayer, who's going to get like triple teamed, although USC hasn't been able to stop very many people. So it'll be pretty interesting to see what they do to Mayer. But the goal of Notre Dame, much like the goal of Michigan, is to keep the ball out of the hands of the guy who's going to be one of the top two quarterbacks picked in the NFL draft in their draft year. You know, Caleb Williams is either going to be the first or second. CJ Stroud or Bryce Young is going to be the first or the second in this draft. So you need to rely heavily on your run game. One of the cool things about Notre Dame this year is they brought back Harry Hiestand, the old O-line coach, and they have two huge, massive, young, talented offensive tackles, Alt and Blake Fishers. And they were not ready to start the season. They played like young players at a position where it's hard to play young. And they played like inexperienced players. And I think that's been one of the wholesale changes is they've just grown up and matured like you do when you play 10, 11 football games together. And I think that they've been able to carve an identity through that Notre Dame run game. And if they can do that against a USC defense that hasn't been able to stop anybody, run, pass, boat, moat, like they haven't, you know, they have been, USC's defense has been as porous as advertised, but credit Alex Grinch, they figured out a way to have one more than everybody but Utah. So
it will be interesting. They take the ball away or they take it when you give it away. That's the one thing they do defensively.
Yes, they will let you, if they don't turn you over, they will let you score to turn you over because that's pretty much how it's gone.
You can stop me if I've, well, no, you can't because we're on a podcast, but, if I've told you this story before, when Spurrier was at Florida and he had Bobby Pruitt, the Marshall head coach, as his defensive coordinator, they went to Ole Miss when Tuberville was there in the throes of NCAA sanctions, completely, you know, outmanned team. And Tuberville was trying to, you know, run the ball and slow the game down and control it, keep Florida's offense off the field. So they start the second half and, you know, they're, Ole Miss is moving the ball and they're, you know, they get third and three, they convert on, you know, first down, second down, third and two, convert again, third and six. Oh, they threw a pass. They got seven, you know, so now the clock's going tick, 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 tick. It's, you know, dwindling away third quarter and the Gators haven't touched the ball. And so Spurrier walks up to Pruitt once, doesn't say anything, turns around, walks away. Now they've eaten up like over half the third quarter. They're still just at about the Florida 30 or 35 or something like this. And Pruitt told me this story years ago. And Spurrier walks up to him again, doesn't do anything. More time runs off the clock. They get down to about the 25 and Spurrier walks up to him the third time. And according to Pruitt, and if Spurrier's listening to this, he'll call me and tell me how I'm wrong on some detail on this. But according to him, Pruitt said to him, or Spurrier said to Pruitt, Bobby, either get the ball back or let them score because I got some ball plays that are going to work. And that's how Lincoln Riley probably is sometimes. Either get the ball or let them score because I've got ball plays with Caleb Williams that are going to work.
Yeah, that's a great story. And
that is sort of how football's evolved in some ways too, where the high octane offenses almost want defenses that can force two turnovers a game because they feel like that's going to be as much of a difference maker as, you know, grinding out a couple punts here and there, or just get it back and go score again. You know, I think that's how football has changed in the last 15 years in some ways.
We're going to see some great stars in that Notre Dame USC game on Saturday night. Caleb Williams, Michael Mayer, best in game, brought to you by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises. I need to qualify this at the beginning by saying that even though I don't think Clemson is great, I thought there was no way that Notre Dame had enough to beat Clemson, and they stomped them. SC's way better than Clemson on offense. They're not even the same universe as Clemson on offense. I'm just having a hard time seeing how Notre Dame wins the game. But I mean, I guess I could think back to that Oregon State game or something like that. They, you know, Oregon State slowed them down, but they, you know, they had the home crowd on their side and stuff. But do you feel that way? I have a hard time. I know the formula: run the ball, throw it to Mayer, control the ball, maybe get a turnover here or there, try to frustrate Caleb, you know, all of that. And I just think at some point you have to have some firepower if you're going to beat them, or you have to have a defense that is going to, you know, sack Williams, get him on the ground, get a bunch of negative plays. And I just don't know that I see that from Notre Dame.
It's interesting that the line is only 5.5.
It is. I know.
Yeah. Now, I know. Vegas has been pretty skeptical of USC this year.
Yeah.
It was a tiny line in that Oregon State game, if you remember. Yeah. And look, maybe rightfully so, right?
I am too. I mean, just to be honest, sure. I am sure. Too. But yeah, it's just, it's hard to see this one for some reason.
It is hard to see this one because there's no, like, I don't think we picked the game right, but we correctly predicted the tenor of USC and UCLA with our friend Bill Connolly last Friday. You know, Bill very dryly said, there are not any defensive statistics that make you think that either team will stop the other or something, right, like something right. Very dry and analytical like that. He was actually very, very accurate, as Bill usually is with his analysis. And I do think that, I wish there was Notre Dame had a little bit more of a dynamic pass rush, because I think you need to rattle Caleb. And Caleb Williams made some throws on the run against UCLA that were just silly. You know, like you fall off the side of your couch. You're like, oh my God, look at that. Look at that. Like he's one of my favorite players in college football. He could be my equivalent of your Drake May quarterback man crush. I just like, there's a smoothness to Caleb Williams.
Yeah.
You know, and do you think he could end up in New York, Reese?
Yeah.
For the Heisman?
Yeah, no, I think he could. If I had to vote right now, I think I might have said this Monday, I would vote for Max Duggan right now. But Caleb's right on his heels. Mm-hmm. It's right there, and both of them are going to have opportunities on pretty big stages. I would argue perhaps Caleb's two stages are going to be bigger because he's got Notre Dame in primetime, a really good Notre Dame team, whereas TCU plays, you know, Iowa State, who will do the two things that Iowa State does. They will play the game close and they will lose the game Saturday. So, I mean,
and it will not be aesthetically pleasing.
It will not be. No, it will not be. But those are the two leaders. But if Corum plays, and certainly Stroud, if he, you know, goes off against Michigan, there it's still kind of open. But I don't only think he could be in New York. I think Caleb could win it. I think there's a real chance he could win it.
Stomping Notre Dame has fueled
many a Heisman candidacy over the years. And if he does, and I'm not saying he will, but if he, you know, if he hangs a 400 burger on him, like that's, you know, going to be a lot of eyeballs when the Trojans and the Irish play.
Old friend Beano Cook used to say, you'll win the Heisman either by playing Notre Dame or playing against Notre Dame. So Caleb will have that opportunity on Saturday. You've been breaking news. We've got coaching contract extensions going on. You had Lance Leipold right before we started doing the podcast.
Yes. So I think, you know, we were lucky enough to go to Lawrence for their first ever game day in October, which I think was like the best crowd we had at game day this year. Would you agree with that?
I don't know that they were the wildest crowd, but they were probably the biggest when you,
yeah, it was just like the most going up daunting the top of the crowd. Hill.
Yeah, they were
just going and going. And it was, anyway, we got to see a little bit of like, Kansas will embrace football. And, Travis Goff and Doug Drow, the chancellor, and others at Kansas have seen the same thing. We had some sources tell us tonight at ESPN that they have now ripped Lance Leipold was only making like $2.3 million this year, which is like SEC coordinator money.
Yeah.
They ripped up his deal. They gave him a new one. They extended him out to 2029. And they basically took a can of off to those pests in Madison and in Lincoln and said, no, you're not coming to get Lance. He has resuscitated us back to relevancy and we are not going to lose him. So credit to Kansas for being proactive. Credit to Kansas. They announced when we were there for game day, a $300 million stadium refurbishing project. That stadium's 103 years old and it doesn't look 95 years old. It looks all 103 of them. So they needed a facelift there. So
If you are going to continue to be an athletic department juggernaut, which Kansas is because of their national championship winning basketball program, you need to have viable and vibrant football. Mm-hmm. And by investing in Lance like they have, by investing in facilities like they're clearly behind some of the Big 12 peers, I think Kansas isn't positioned to be a factor in the Big 12, which just quite frankly, the 15-year period between Mangino and now, which was, if I can go off the top of my head, Turner Gill, Charlie Weiss, David Beatty, and then Les Miles, which is a lot of miles, a bad coaching road in Lawrence. They found a guy and they committed to keep him. And that's what we broke tonight. So we also broke that Curtis Rourke, Ohio University's quarterback, who is going to win the MAC Player of the Year. And I hope he still does. Injured his knee and he's out for the rest of the year. So Ohio is actually playing right now as we tape this podcast for a spot in the MAC title game. So just a bummer that, I think Ohio U was 3-9 last year and they were eight and three heading into tonight. They are winning 31-7. So we will see Ohio play the Toledo Rockets for the MAC title. But it was a bummer for Curtis Rourke. He just had a hell of a season.
Yeah, you hate to see that. We saw it with Hendon Hooker on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And now Rourke. I want to go back to this coaching news. I know you're on top of all of this, but Lane Kiffin called a meeting with his players on Tuesday night to he's sort of like was it Kevin Bacon in Animal House who just kept yelling all is well, or maybe it wasn't him, maybe it was one of the other bad guy fraternities, but to tell his players that his focus was only on Mississippi State and nothing else, and that rumors of him accepting another offer were totally false. He kind of, went after this guy at WCBI TV in Columbus, Mississippi on Twitter about saying that after the Egg Bowl that he was going to take the Auburn job. So, and by the way, WCBI TV, where as a youngster, I won a bicycle from that TV station. But anyway, I digress. So they can't be all bad. But, this says to me that whether he does or doesn't, it's percolating to the point that he had to tell the players something, which doesn't necessarily bode well for the Egg Bowl, one wouldn't think. At least that's the way I read it. And the other thing is all of these so-called denials aren't really denials. They're, I haven't accepted it, I haven't talked. And we all know how that kind of language gets danced around all the time in these coaching searches. So I'd keep an eye on Ole Miss, Mississippi State, and it's hard to evaluate the culture there. Maybe they'll go out and just ball out, in support of him, or say, well, if this is it, if this is the last dance, we're going to go out with a bang. Or maybe they get disillusioned. I mean, you never know how players are going to react to something like that when things are swirling about, and how much he might have calmed things, as if they in fact needed to be calmed. But that the reports are out there that he had a meeting with the players and at least addressed it.
Yes. Auburn gymnast Suni Lee, one of the great American gymnasts who played collegiately at Auburn, would appreciate the semantical gymnastics that go on this time of year, because there are certainly
great analogy.
There's certainly some language things stretched. And, I think it's safe to say that Lane Kiffin remains the favorite for the Auburn job. But I will say this, there are two very unpredictable variables involved here: Lane Kiffin and Auburn. Those are not two linear entities, Team Kiffin and Team War Eagle. So would it shock me if, a week from today, we're talking about Lane Kiffin being the Auburn coach? It wouldn't shock me. It wouldn't shock anybody, right? No. Now, I know how much the Egg Bowl means to people in Mississippi. I've covered Egg Bowls. Like, I've spent a bunch of time on both campuses there. You hate that, for the biggest game of the year in the state of Mississippi, that something like this is lingering over it, and he felt compelled to tell his team that. But in the report that came out was took some liberties. Wasn't exactly a Woodward and Bernstein job. But look, there's a likelihood that Kiffin's the favorite there. I don't think that comes as a surprise to anyone.
No.
So we shall see how it unfolds. But that is Lane Kiffin trolling the reporter on Twitter was both predictable and delightful.
And, you know, and most coaches just get mad at, you know, something. And instead he goes that way. But if he takes the job and he takes it on Friday, well, then he's gonna have to own it and apologize to the guy. You know?
Yeah, I mean that seems a little quick.
Well, he's not going to, but yeah. You know, there's one devout Auburn fan in my house
who's
my wife.
I know.
She went to Auburn and she's all in on Cadillac. And
interesting.
And in fact, she's not the only one. Cadillac Williams has unified that fan base. Now it's a stretch because there are things that happen in an interim that we've seen on a couple of occasions with, let's say Ed Orgeron. And so you have to make a wise choice. And I'm not saying that Carnell's not a wise choice. There's not a lot of experience there, but the one thing Auburn has needed in its fractured state, even at the end of the Malzahn era, is someone to pull them together and in the same direction. And Cadillac has the support of the players. I think they are going to play their tails off Saturday in Tuscaloosa. And there are some around Tuscaloosa that are very worried about that too, that the intensity that will come from Cadillac's team will not be matched by a somewhat saying the right things, but somewhat disillusioned group in Tuscaloosa over their playoff fate. So should that happen, I mean, the unpredictable factor of Auburn really comes into play there. If they haven't made a call, if it's not on Friday, if they're still waiting, and then Auburn wins in Tuscaloosa with Cadillac Williams as the head coach, then things change.
I want to get behind this Cadillac movement because he's been unbelievable. He's just been this lightning bolt, complete surprise. I just can't get out of the back of my mind how badly he bungled the clock management at the end of the Mississippi State game when he was icing the kicker with 32 seconds left instead of like saving that for his own. Again, he's an inexperienced coach and does that, but that's probably the most I've watched of Auburn. So, you know, I didn't watch much of the Western Kentucky game, since then. So that, like, that's, you know, your impression is your impression. Right. But you know, happy for that fan base, obviously, that has had to deal with bad leadership and boogeyman boosters and all this stuff, that one of their own comes and takes a lost season, right? It was not a stretch in August. Like if there were Vegas odds on whose season was going to be just lost in the wilderness, Auburn would have been even money. And pulled it out from that dangling bowl eligibility. I was really happy to see that, look, so much of college sports fandom is nostalgia, right? So when one of your own that you value and love the most comes back and delivers the place you love to greatness, there's just a collision, a powerful collision. Is it built for the long term? Boy, Auburn's a hard job, man. It's chewed up and spit out some good coaches. So yeah, I don't see it happening, but I do think the conversation takes on a completely different tenor if Cadillac topples old Nick Saban.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too. I still suspect that won't be the direction Auburn goes. Maybe if he were 5 years down the road and, you know, in his coaching career, you know, with a little bit more experience, just being a coach, he hasn't been a coach at all that long. You know, then maybe it's a little bit different. The thing is, I suspect Lane's the front runner. That's who I anticipate getting the job, whether it's Lane or whether it's Hugh Freeze. Either of those,
who, by the way, are 0-4 in their last two games.
Exactly. Either one of those would quickly, I think, unify the fan base, even those who are supportive of Cadillac taking over a full time.
I think it'd be hard to not hire Cadillac if you're in making the associate head coach.
Oh,
if you're
absolutely.
The new Auburn coach. Right. I think that's like,
yeah,
you know, yeah. The running back coach at Ole Miss right now is like, oh man.
I'm gonna tell you, here's what Nick Saban or Kirby Smart should do. Ooh. When, you know, if he doesn't get the job, they should try to hire him. The two biggest rivals, they should go try to hire him and you know, make him associate head coach.
No,
you know, it's all's fair in that. We've had the lightning bolt, you know, South Carolina last week, knocking Tennessee out of the playoff picture completely. If you had to pick a lightning bolt Saturday, where would it be?
I had to pick a lightning bolt on Saturday. Let me look at the schedule here.
Well, you've got Iowa State, TCU. You know, Ohio State, Michigan wouldn't be it. Georgia Tech, Georgia, or South Carolina again against Clemson, or Texas A&M, LSU, for that matter.
I ain't giving any oxygen to that. Well, it won't have the stakes, but I think Oregon State, I read, has won 10 of 11 in the Civil War at Reser. Don't use that on the show. I thought I saw that this week. Yeah. Marissa Dowling, our ace researcher, who's a magician, for us on game day. That would be, you know, if I had my lightning candidates, I'll take the Beavers and I'll take the Irish. Just somebody knows something. Somebody knows something.
That's they do. So what's the best trophy? What's the best right? What's your favorite rivalry trophy?
That's a good question. It would have to be one of those. I don't have one off the top of my head.
What about Paul Bunyan's axe?
Oh, that's good.
You know, they run in Minnesota, Wisconsin. They run and get it, and they try to they fake chopping down the goalpost. That's a pretty good one.
I've been to the world's largest Paul Bunyan statue in I believe it's in Minnesota. So
how big is it?
It's a roadside. I want to say it might be in Shakopee, Minnesota.
Oh, okay. I know what you said because I just looked up the Oregon State thing. I misunderstood what you said. You're saying they've won 10 of their last 11 overall games at Reser. I thought you were saying, I was like, that doesn't ring true about they've won 10 of the last 11 meetings with Oregon. But you mean just
at
winning
home.
Games at home, winning
Correct.
Home games.
At
yeah,
home.
With yes. with the lone loss being to SC this year. Yes, that is correct. You saw that correctly. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. That's my fault if I didn't.
No, you didn't. That was me not hearing it properly, I'm sure.
Yeah. So there's four large Paul. It's Akeley, Minnesota, one of the Paul Bunyan statue I've been to, but there's also one in Bangor, Maine. There's one in Bemidji, Minnesota, and then there's one in Klamath, California, which I believe is actually the longest. So I will take, I enjoy a Bunyan-esque statue. What's yours, Reese?
Well, my favorite trophy is the $5 bits of broken chair because it's just so absurd. But it's the Paul Bunyan axe because when I was working in the studio, I was in studio the day that Reese Lloyd kicked that field goal and they hadn't had the axe in 100 years that's an exaggeration, but it was a long time. And he ran over and grabbed the thing, you know, and that was.
Would you remember his name if it was Bill Lloyd and not Reese?
Well, I would have because he was an Englishman, I believe.
Now that you say this, this is starting to ring a faint bell in my mind. So.
You remember him?
Yes. Yes. I just remember like the story, you know what I mean? The British guy, you know, like.
Yeah.
He was a kicker
from Minnesota, went over there, kicked the game winning field goal. You know, Minnesota hadn't been great. You know, Wisconsin's kind of had it really going under Alvarez there and they won the game and he went over and got it. It was a, you know, great memorable moment in that rivalry.
Yeah. No doubt.
Old Oak and Bucket, the end of that one.
So I'm not a trophy guy.
Why not? You're college football is the nostalgia.
I don't have a trophy. I enjoy the ridiculousness of them. I just don't have a, and if I enjoy the overall, like just chicanery that comes with them, but I don't have a preferred one. In the Big Ten, it's like one every week. It's hard to keep track. You know,
that's true. Like I'd forgotten.
I wonder if they have a commissioner for trophies. It's like,
Like the old brass spittoon was last week, I think, with Michigan State and Indiana. I think that's right.
Yeah. So. That's like a big studio host thing. Like if you're in the studio, you want to get that trophy like talked up a little bit. And plus, in a lot of these Big Ten games, the trophies are more interesting than the game themselves.
That could well be true. That could well be true for the Axe on Saturday for sure.
Bet the under.
Bet the under, and we'll try to get some picks right in the race for the ribeye on Friday. Good job breaking stories. Really looking forward to what we're going to do on game day with your piece, with the coaches' inside scoops and our guys' reaction to it with some tape and so forth. So I appreciate you doing the podcast. We're doing it at night and not awakening young Teddy. So hopefully he slept through all of this.
I had to keep my inside voice on. So no, I think Saturday is going to be awesome. I mean, a full coda for me in my first year game day. We start in Columbus, obviously week one, with Ryan Day famously telling me to breathe after my first hit because I think I spit every word in two syllables. So hopefully, maybe have a little rain, little elements maybe affecting us on Saturday.
Affect us, and well, remains to be seen whether it's going to affect Ohio State. I mean, it's a school of thought that the worse the weather, the better it is for the school from Ann Arbor. So
lines dropping.
Is it really?
It went so I started to write my story the other day. It was 8.5, and then I checked when I filed it today, and it was 7.5. So we're Tuesday night. I started on Sunday night. So yeah, some money coming in on the boys from Ann Arbor. The people who were convicted on Michigan were convicted. The coaches. So
yeah, I know you're not going to give away any sources. Generally speaking, the people convicted on Michigan, were they kind of old school guys?
I think that's fair, right? Like the argument for is physicality, toughness, special teams, complementary football, you know, all acknowledging that Ohio State has more talent. So plus people do these, they like to be a little counterintuitive. Let's be honest. You know,
like you want to sound like the smartest guy. You want to be the guy who had the right angle. Special teams is a good one because historically, you know, 97 Woodson, 91 Desmond with the big punt returns. It ended up leading the Wolverines.
I want to say the JT Barrett game, there was a blocked punt.
There was Chris Olave blocked it.
Chris Olave as a freshman. That was the first time I'd ever heard his name. Yeah.
Yeah. He was wearing a different number back then too. I think he had changed numbers or something that week too. So it was, but I remember Olave
worked out okay for old Chris Olave, didn't it?
Yeah. Things have gone well for him. Pete, we will talk on Friday, man. Always fun. Thanks for listening to the College Game Day podcast. We'll make some picks on Friday. We'll have to put our money where our mouths are on Michigan and Ohio State, on SC Notre Dame. It's all coming up then. You can download the podcast wherever it is that you like to listen to podcasts. See you on Friday.